Live from the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA 1050 AM, 102.3 FM and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel with Turf's Up Radio Studio, and they're the only radio station dedicated to the green industry. So we welcome them and everybody today. I'm Rob Starr. I usually say along with my co-host, Mr. Chris Davies, but he's at home enjoying his daughter who flew in from the East Coast. And I bet he's glad to see her because they live in Florida. And I think she was close to the hurricane or experienced a little of it, but she's safe and she's here and she's going to stay with mom and dad for a couple of days. And that's a good thing. So anyway, that's the way that's working. It's a beautiful day today. It's 97 degrees as I came in here to the studio here at 5:45, and it's supposed to be hotter tomorrow and Sunday, and then cool off on Monday, which will be really, really nice. And it's wonderful to be here in California. I'm usually from the East Coast. Well, not usually. I was born in the East Coast, and I missed the snow. But we got snow in the wintertime, and there's actually still snow up on a mountain I was reading about in Maven's notebook, and we're going to bring the person who knows everything about water. In fact, before the governor knows what he's going to say about water, he calls Chris Austin to check up and make sure she knows what's going to be the right thing for him to say. So well, I want to welcome the wonderful person who is the purveyor of Maven's notebook in California and can be read all around the world, Miss Chris Austin.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing good, and I got to get you turned up in my headphones because I can barely hear you.
Okay.
Oh, you're there now. All right. Great, 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 great. Sorry, we had a sports show that was here before me, and when I got here and put the headphones on, there's a control from 1 to 10, 10 being the loudest, and it was on 10. Almost fried my ears out. I couldn't believe it was so loud. I guess maybe he has a hearing problem, but that's okay. He did a good show, so I can't complain. But a lot going on in the news today, especially about water, and that's why we have you, and we appreciate that. We also have a great guest coming up afterwards, Ms. Brenda Berman, who is the Commissioner of the United States Bureau of Reclamation. We're very honored to have her on the show as well, and that'll be
7:30.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. My son is talking to me in my other ear. I'm trying to tell him I'm doing my radio show, and he's
put him on the air. Put him on the air. I would say hi to him.
He's apologizing now.
Oh.
But yeah.
Oh, like, I can't talk to him?
No.
Okay.
He's walking out the door. You be home for dinner?
I know what that's like, having kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I'm sitting in my front room because I work out of my house.
Right.
So, you know, I don't really have a separate place to go. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on today and this week. I mean, I guess the main big thing is, you
SB1.
Know, are they going to pass this bill? It's called SB1.
Right.
And the intention is to, you know, counter the rollbacks on the environmental protections that the Trump administration is doing. But there's provisions in there that the water interests say are really going to mess with things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, these voluntary agreements, which they've been trying to negotiate to get more water for the Delta and, you know, more help for the fish. And this is the great, I think this is the great hope that, you know, we might be able to get all these parties to agree to something rather than the endless litigation that occurs. And so, you know, they feel that this SB1 is going to stand in the way of that. And, you know, the environmentalists are very much for it, and the water interest and the especially the farmers, are very much against it. And it will be interesting to see how it plays out. All the bills, anything that the legislature is going to do in this first year of activity has to happen by Friday. And if there are, they can pull this bill and make it what they call a two-year bill, because our legislature runs in two-year cycles.
Right.
And so they can, you you know, that would mean they would take this up again in January, and, you know, try and see if they can get it to pass next year, or they can, you know, just kill it now or pass it now. So it will be interesting to see what happens. There's a great desire, I think, in much of the state government to sort of counter a lot of the things that the Trump administration is doing, but it does present problems, I do believe, when you try to write something that's broad.
Of course.
Well, there was
quote you had in there that somebody said, I guess, from the state legislator. President Donald Trump's administration for the duration of his term or terms, it is a clause that would expire the day he leaves office in 2025 if he wins a second term. And I was just reading also, not on your thing, in another article somewhere, it said that the state of California has sued the Trump administration 58 times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I never knew that an attorney general, you know, what does the attorney general do? And I figured it out with Attorney General Becerra. They file lawsuits,
you know,
or at least that's what ours does. But that's sort of been the stance of the state of California. And, you know, there may be things you agree with and that the Trump administration is doing and things you may not agree with. You know, the one thing that you know is concerning is, you know, that the rollback on the car emission standards, because when I came here 20 years ago, the air pollution was so much worse.
Yep.
And, you know, that's one of the ways that they made it a lot better. And I don't want to see it go back to the days when, you know, when you would go, I would go down into the Mid-Wilshire District and you couldn't see three blocks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was incredible.
Well, I went to private school in Van Nuys, and we couldn't play basketball or football because it was so smoggy outside. It was really terrible. I was way back. I won't tell you what year it was, but it was a long time ago.
Those
were the things that we had. Hey, just so you know, the engineer had to run out to do something personal, and I don't know what. Oh, he's back. Hey, Nick, we had a phone call, but that's okay. You're not here. I was going to answer it, but I couldn't do it. Our engineer's back now. He had to go talk to the GM. You talked to the GM, got it all straightened out? You told him you're the boss of the show? Okay, good. Sorry about that. I was going to answer the phone while we were talking and do that. Yeah, you know, I just keep reading. That's all we do is file lawsuits, and that's where all our tax money goes. And I know they do them for a reason, but, you know, I get to read a lot of these things, and I think it's more political than it is trying to solve the issue. And I wish they'd stop doing that and solve the issues, because we got a lot of issues that they've never resolved yet. And they better.
Oh, absolutely. And we could go into all of that. But hey, we're supposed to be talking about water.
Absolutely.
So we should get back to the water.
Absolutely.
We'll talk the listeners
about
water. Want.
Well, I was crying. I was making more water.
Yeah. Now there was an interesting, provocative sort of article today that came out on KCET. You know, they passed a piece of legislation, SB 307, and the governor signed it. And this legislation was really aimed at, I think, stopping the Cadiz project,
right,
which is a project that's going on out in the far, Riverside
Desert.
County.
Yep, San Bernardino County.
Right. Yep. It's way out there. And they want to bring in like 50,000 acre feet. It's a groundwater. They want to pump groundwater from the aquifer. And I think the presumption is that, you know, 50,000 acre feet gets replenished.
It's like 16 billion gallons of groundwater.
Yeah, but, you know, when you start talking gallons, you know, 16 billion gallons in terms of acre feet is not a whole lot. But
no,
it sounds much better when you say it is 16 billion gallons, right?
Yeah.
It's, relatively speaking, the Cadiz project, to say the state water project input into Southern California. I mean, Metropolitan Water District has a buy in the state water project at two million acre feet, or about 50% of the yield of that project. I think it's just under 50%. But if the state water project delivered everything, and that would be 2 million acre feet, the Cadiz project, by, you know, relative to that, 50,000 acre feet. I mean, it's very small amount. And they want to bring this in and take it down to some water agencies on the coast. And this is a private sort of enterprise, which is, you know, there's a certain element of the population that gets very concerned when water becomes privatized and people are going to make a lot of money off it. And this project has been kicking around for literally decades.
Yep.
And Metropolitan at one point was considering it, and then they decided they weren't interested in it, and they haven't picked up the ball since, and it's been at least a decade since, and they have shown no interest. And part of this project involves transporting this water through Metropolitan's water infrastructure. And so far, there's, as far as I know about what's gone on with the project, I don't think Metropolitan has come to that table to, you know, agree on what the cost would be, or even to agree to do it at all. I mean, if Metropolitan owns their infrastructure, I don't think anyone, any court can come in and say, you have to do this.
No, it's private, you know. Private stuff. You know,
So anyways, they passed this law to require more environmental review for this project. And the way that it's written, I think they were trying to target Cadiz, but there's some question as to whether other projects now, other groundwater projects that are going into action, are going to have to go through all this additional review.
Yeah.
But the article didn't really go into much more detail than saying that, you know, it could affect projects, and it could be, and a lot more than the Cadiz project could now be subject to further environmental review. So we'll see.
We had their chairman on, Scott Slater, on the show a while back, and he was, you know, this is in the early days, and he was telling us about all the lawsuits they were going through to make sure there wasn't any of the chromium stuff in the water and things of that sort. But I also found out the other day that, and they made an announcement that they're going to start a marijuana field.
Yeah, hemp field. Actually, I think it's hemp. Yeah, which is different than marijuana.
I don't do the drugs, so I'm not sure of all the right terminologies here, but
but hemp is like more of an industrial product,
right.
And it's actually kind of useful for a lot of different things, but smoking it is not one of them. So, but interestingly, by, you know, the statutes that the federal government put in place against marijuana, it also ended up including hemp. But now, you know, those things have, at least that part has become a little bit more relaxed. And hemp has a lot of, you know, great uses and, you know, all sorts of different products that's showing up in there.
Well, there's a lot of medical things to that, but I also heard, you know, again, we talk about that, and I won't get off subject anymore, but the vaping problem that they're having now, what they said with the hemp and the E-acidic or something like that, that's causing lung problems.
Yeah, so, I don't know. That's really scary stuff. And when you see these, you know, the fact that these kids stuck in a device and you know, spit out like two thunderclouds worth of smoke. I mean, I never saw cigarettes do that.
No.
You know, I mean, you just gotta know that's pretty intense, and there's got to be a consequence for that kind of thing. But
it's crazy.
Anyways, we're not talking about water.
It's all related. They got to grow this stuff with water.
Yeah. Interestingly, cannabis started out with people thinking it was going to be a big water problem, but I think it is in terms of up in the northern coast where people put up a lot of farms and tried to farm, you know, wanted to farm cannabis and divert water from already diverted Russian River and Humboldt and all those sorts of areas. But really down in Southern California, it came to be everyone's understanding it's a lot of times grown indoors. And it doesn't really become a water problem because they're buying water at retail rates, you know, as businesses pay. It's actually more of a power issue because the lights that they grow it indoors with suck up a whole heck of a lot of electricity.
Yeah.
And so it becomes more of a greenhouse gas issue, not necessarily a water issue here, at least in Southern California. We still have the black market stuff going on up in the forest and in the hills. And there's been a number of busts this summer to kind of try and, get that down. That's the really scary stuff because those people are using pesticides and God only knows what, and they're putting this stuff around, in the mountains to kill bears and whatever, and if you're out there hiking, it can be dangerous. So, one of the hopes of passing the cannabis legislation was, the ballot measure was maybe that there'd be less of that. And so I don't know if they've actually accomplished in having less of that, but at least they're still working on trying to get those operations out of the mountains.
Yeah. Well, there's another bill that's important is the one that Senator Melissa Hurtado did. I guess it was Senate Bill 513, I think. And that's supposed to be heading up to Gavin Newsom's, our governor. It received bipartisan support, and it's supposed to provide relief for families without reliable access to water. So
yeah, water equity and, rising water bills, it's a problem for the poor people, and it's something that's gotten a lot of discussion, clean water, available in low-income and disadvantaged communities. The state of California did pass a bill of the human right to water, which means that, we committed to making clean water run through everybody's homes and in a manner that they can afford to pay for it. So, there was definitely some movement this year on that with the passage of the, Governor Newsom's plan and, with this other law passing to, keep it affordable. So we'll see how it works. But there's some money behind it, money behind Newsom's measure, so... Hopefully we will solve the problem.
Yep. So I saw that UCLA was doing a study about the progress on the goal to guarantee water as a human right, and I guess that's pushing forward.
Yeah. I mean, the news is good that we're working towards that. A lot of focus also has been lately, and it's been coming out of the state water board and the regional water boards, is a focus on homelessness and what this means to water quality. Because a lot of these people, they end up, sort of camping out in the waterways or close to them and in other places. And, people got to do what they got to do when they got to do it. And, that causes issues because, those chemicals or whatever, however you want to say it, those contaminants, kind of end up in the gutters and the waterways and they're not being treated. And E. coli in rivers now is becoming a common problem in a lot of these places. And even in Sacramento, they're having problems. There's a big homeless population in Sacramento, and they live by the river.
Mm.
And, we did figure out how to, do effective health and sanitation decades, back at the, turn of the 19th century. But we're not set up to deal with a large amount of homeless people, and as more people end up on the streets, it affects all sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, they got the state has a lot to do with stuff. They got a lot of work ahead of them. I hope they just concentrate and take care of these issues one by one, because just like the Cadiz thing, I mean, that's been going on, like you said, for decades. And, you know, all these projects just take forever with all these tests that they got to do, and then all these, which I'm glad they do that. I'm glad they have the public, you know, rounds that people can give the comments and things of that sort. But, God, it just takes forever and ever and ever, and it seems like nothing gets done. I know it does, but it's just really slow. I just wish it
would. Yeah, and, you know, we'll see. But there's a lot of things to be dealt with.
Yep.
And you know, we'll see what happens from here. We have the governor's water resilience portfolio. He's been having, you know, these listening sessions all across the state, and now people are starting to submit their list of recommendations. So we'll see what comes out of this. You know, it will be interesting to see. A lot of newcomers to California water tend to be very optimistic and hopeful that it could be easily solved if we all listen to each other and rap, rap, rap. And well, those people, of us that have been around kind of go, oh, yeah, I used to think like that.
Well, everybody wants, I mean, a lot of people want to, I'll say it for me only, I like to see instant gratification. I like to see things happen very quickly, and you know, when somebody gets an idea, you go do it and take care of it. Yes, you got to understand it and make sure you got right plans and all that. But God, I just wish they would cut down on time. I mean, we still got infrastructure problems and things of that they've been talking about for 15 years that I know of, or longer. But we got to solve them all, and hopefully the people in the state legislature are doing that. And I just encourage them to sit down, and you know, they have one. Each side has their own opinion, but you know. Both sides should give in. We got to work for the best of the people, and
absolutely.
And we need water, and water is important. So, you know,
and hopefully that with the passage of these new bills with this legislative session, that it will mean clean water for the people of the Central Valley in these communities that have this terrible water.
Absolutely, totally agree.
You know, that's really the hope that yep. they can have fresh water coming out of their taps just like we all enjoy.
Absolutely. Everybody's equal, and they should all have clean water. Well, anyway, I just want to remind our listeners, if you want to know more about water in California, the best place, I think the governor even reads your stuff in the morning, and then he makes his actions on that.
But oh,
you
go, I hope so.
You go to mavensnotebook.com. You can be a subscriber to that. If you want to be a sponsor of that, you can do that as well. Chris knows everything about water. I mean, she is my goddess of water, and I appreciate that. And I'm glad she's on our show, and it makes our show really good, and we appreciate that. So, Chris, thank you very much. We're up against our break time, and then we're going to bring on our other guest. So we will talk to you, I think it's an action next week, but I'll let you know that, and we'll talk to you shortly.
Okay. Have a good evening, guys.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
We're going to be back in just a minute or two. Just take a quick break, and then we're going to bring on our special guest, Ms. Brenda Berman. And so stick around, and she's from the government, the big cheese of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. So stand by. We'll be right back.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. Eco Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco Solvent Cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
They love you. They love you not. They love you. Satisfying your customers, it's a full-time job. Want an easy way to make them happy? Try having your ornamentals delivered straight to the job site with Nursery Direct. Could save you and your clients a pretty penny. Think about it, instead of driving to the nearest nursery, picking up the order, and then driving to the job site, the crew's able to begin work right away. That cuts time and labor. Savings you can pass on to your customers, and you can get your plants delivered direct, even if you don't have a nursery branch in your area. Here's another quick tip. Keep a substitutions list on standby for every project, so your team knows what to do in case a plant isn't in stock. Because there's nothing customers appreciate more than a project that finishes on time and on budget. They love you. They really love you. Aww.
They love us, they love us not. They love us, they love us not. I'm trying to be like the guy in the commercial, but he's better than me. He's a pro. Anyway, I'm very proud to have our next guest come on in, and Chris Davey and I had the great appreciation for meeting with this lady and having a conversation with her. Subsequently to that, we had met her a year ago at the Orange County Water District Symposium, and we were lucky enough to have her on the show. So she's a biggie, and she's the head of the United States Bureau of Reclamation. So we're going to bring Brenda on here in a second.
Well, tonight we're very honored to have someone of note, and we're very excited to have this person on, and I'll introduce her. Her name is Ms. Brenda Berman, and she is the Commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. So, Commissioner, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We appreciate you taking the time to join us. So, a lot of things we like to do first is just get to know you a little better, and we'll keep it simple. I always wonder how people always got into their career. Sometimes you plan all through high school and college what you want to be in life, and then you wind up doing something different, or maybe you fulfill your dreams on that. So can you kind of give our listening audience a little bit of how you got into the water business and some of your background in water management?
Yes, thanks. As my first real summer job, I worked for the Park Service in New Mexico. I was trail crew out in the desert sun, and that's where I fell in love with the Southwest. That's where I learned the importance and value of water. In that landscape, you can't work, you can't live. We were camping out in the desert unless you know where your water is, that you have a reliable water supply. And since then, I've worked across the West. Early in my career, I focused on tribal water settlements. I focused on how do you provide water to tribes, but also at the same time, how do you make sure that they're reliable supplies for the neighboring communities. And one of the things I found, and which was just incredible to work on, was you really need to bring all those communities together. You need to be able to find those durable solutions. How are people going to agree to share that scarce resource? And working in water, that was just sort of a first taste of it for me. I did that early on in private practice. I did that as legal counsel to U.S. Senator John Kyle out here in Washington, D.C., but representing Arizona, and just realized how key water was to Arizona, but also to the West. My other opportunities, I've looked for other water opportunities. I was able to work for Reclamation 12 years ago. I've worked for the Nature Conservancy. I've worked for large water districts who deliver water to our major southwestern cities and the agriculture that supports them. And what I've seen, what I've learned is it's just continued my passion to work on water. No matter where you're working, water is complex. It takes problem solving. It's a fascinating area. The people who work in water are creative. They want to solve problems. They're protecting their own resources and their own communities, but they're also looking for broader solutions. So I've just found it incredibly challenging. Water really is the essential lifeblood of the West, the backbone of the West. And so now getting the chance to work as the Reclamation Commissioner, it's really an honor. But it's also a chance to look west-wide at these various water challenges. Reclamation is uniquely suited to help communities deliver reliable water and affordable power supplies. So I'm here to help them do that.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I believe you have a legal background as well. Is that correct?
That's right. University of Arizona. Go Wildcats.
That's good. You know, you and my daughter have something in common. You're both attorneys, and she works for the federal government. She's a special agent in the FBI. So, anyway, for our listeners that might not be familiar with the USBR, can you kind of tell us what that agency does?
Yes. So over 100 years ago, President Theodore Roosevelt saw the potential in the West. He looked out at the vast resources that the West had to offer the nation, and he saw that the right investment in infrastructure could bring reliable water and power supplies, which really were going to be what was necessary for settlement, to bring up the economies of the West, so the West could thrive and survive in the same way that the East Coast was. And that was the beginning of reclamation. So Teddy Roosevelt sent our engineers. He scattered them across the West, and it's our great infrastructure that we know today, whether that's Hoover Dam or Grand Coulee Dam or Shasta, built by reclamation. Our mission is to deliver reliable water and power supplies in an environmentally and economically sound manner. And we work hard to carefully balance the needs of farmers and families, growing municipal demands, natural resources. In the 20th century, I think we were known for our great infrastructure. And that's still true today, but today it's the 21st century, so there are different ways of accomplishing our mission. And so today we're engineers, but we're also biologists, we're economists, we're cultural resource specialists. It takes a diverse workforce to meet kind of our diverse challenges as we look across what are we going to do in the West. And what I also think is so interesting about reclamation is, in 1902 we started off with our first projects, but today we operate almost 500 dams. We have 338 reservoirs. We deliver water to more than 40 million people and 10 million acres of farmland. We're a great part of the economic output of the West. But today our mission is really just amplifies what Teddy Roosevelt wanted to accomplish. We want to manage, develop, and protect water and related resources in the American West for the environmentally and economically sound manner.
Hey, that was a very comprehensive summary, Brenda. I appreciate that a great deal. So this is Chris. Welcome to the show. I've been tossed the next question, so I get a turn. And based on what you just said, right? As you look across the West, whereas you just mentioned the USBR or Reclamation, as we'll call it for short, you guys operate most of the major facilities that provide water to cities and farms. So you gave us a little bit a summary of what some of the priorities are. But what do you think needs to be the USBR's or Reclamation's focus coming up?
To me, Reclamation exists today for the same reason it did a century ago, and that is to help make your water and power supplies more reliable and dependable. Given that, since I've been sworn in, Reclamation, we have focused on investing in our infrastructure. The great infrastructure that the past generations brought us, modernizing it, making sure it's reliable into the future, but also planning, looking ahead. How are we going to plan for the future? Working with our partners to ensure we have reliable water and power. The generation before us, our parents, our grandparents, they built the infrastructure we're relying on today. So when I look at it, it's how are we going to plan for tomorrow? We're going to make repairs. We're going to make replacements. We are working across the West on so many projects. Maybe one example. I think your listeners are very familiar with Hoover Dam and Lake Mead. Well, Lake Mead right now is at 39% of capacity. And we know that the power plants, the power generation, was built basically to have full reservoirs. So how do we make sure that our power supply is reliable, even when we have less water to work with? Well, what we've done is we've worked with our partners. We've worked with the beneficiaries of that power. And we've invested. So we've invested in new turbines. We've invested in new ways to make sure that the water is just as reliable today. They can have the same economic output, but with less water. So those are some of the ways we're working today to make sure that water is reliable tomorrow, but also water is reliable in 50 years.
A ton of challenges for you, for sure. I know, Brenda, but I know that also that that the USBR and the Department of the Interior, right, work together. There's a huge presence you both have in the Colorado River Basin, all of which you just mentioned in your last answer. So what's the department's role really in managing the Colorado River from a broad perspective?
We have a broad role. The Colorado River is the single most important water resource for the southwestern United States, for northwestern Mexico. Ultimately, it's a modest river, but it's shared among 9 states and 2 countries. It's very unique in the United States and really unique in the world, and that's because we have massive storage on the Colorado River. We have the ability to store almost 4 times of the average annual flow, which is pretty great. You know, Hoover, you look at Hoover and what was done with Hoover. So Hoover Dam, built in the 1930s, really the start of reclamations management on the Colorado River. It was the Depression. People camped out in the desert for a year just for the opportunity to work. But it was American ingenuity kind of at our most downtrodden. And it became this beacon of hope because it's an engineering marvel. Today it's one of the major man-made wonders of the world. But that, together with the other storage that we've built on the Colorado River, has allowed us to manage it in a way that many other systems, we just don't get that opportunity. So wet year, dry year, we're able to use that system to make sure we're reliable.
Can you tell us about some of the current drought and challenges that's facing the Colorado River? Because that's our mainstream that we need the water from.
Southern California, for sure.
It is the prime water source. I mean, you think about Denver, Los Angeles, San Diego, you know, the great farm fields, Phoenix. That's really, you know, the prime water source is the Colorado River. But what we know is that we've been in a drought for 20 years. And since that drought began in 2000, we've realized that it is the driest 20 years on record. And what I think is really interesting is the scientists can look beyond the record now. They can look back over 1,000 years. And what they tell us is this is really one of the driest periods we've seen in the history of the Colorado River. So it's pretty unprecedented. And you think about, like, how have we gotten through this? Well, it's back to that storage. It's also partnerships and conservation and all these different things. But overwhelmingly, you look at, we have that storage, and that is what has allowed us to survive a 20-year drought.
Well, for here, the big news this year was the completion of the drought contingency plans for the Colorado River Basin. So how do those plans protect the basin, and really, what are the keys to their success?
The drought contingency plans are really, it was such an amazing effort. It was the 7 basin states coming together. It was the country of Mexico. It was tribes. It was NGOs, all facilitated by Reclamation and the Department of Interior. And the idea was everyone pulling together on a common goal. We knew we've survived so far on the Colorado River with storage, with conservation, with different programs. But when we looked out ahead, We saw that if this drought continues, if drought is with us in the future, we weren't sure that we were going to be able to be as reliable. We weren't sure that we would be able to keep delivering water supplies. Would we face a crisis in the future? And we saw one coming close. We saw one on the horizon. So it was very important for everyone to come together. Kind of like when I worked on Indian water rights settlements almost 20 years ago. This was just that times 20. You know, it was just so many different parties, so many different water districts. It took a lot of time, but really the ability was to bring everyone together to buy down that risk. The risk was too high. We were going to face crisis and not be able to deliver water to those cities, to those farms, to those communities. And the drought contingency plans are really incredible. They're a little bit different in the upper basin and lower basin. So if you're in the upper basin, that's Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, they are looking at how can they protect Lake Powell. How can they, that's their main water reservoir that they use to deliver water down to the south. How do they protect that? And in the lower basin, which is California, Nevada, Arizona, the idea was how do we protect Lake Mead? How do we make sure that Lake Mead doesn't fall to critically low elevations? And we've done that by increasing the flexibility that water users have, by incentivizing conservation, storing and saving water that you don't use behind Lake Mead to protect those elevations, but also looking at if the water is at certain elevations, then you make contributions to the system. So in 2020, Nevada and Arizona will be making contributions to the system. That's going to happen immediately. And if the elevations at Lake Mead continue to fall, then California will be part of that too. But this new conservation, this new flexibility that we're talking about, it has already had some amazing results. So just in 2019, we are looking at over 750,000 acre feet of water that's being saved behind Hoover Dam. If you think about it, that's over 2 years of Nevada's entire supply. It adds nearly 8 feet of water to Lake Mead, and it's reducing the risk of us hitting critically low elevations in the future.
Terrific answer, Brenda. Thank you very much. And our listeners, I know, are going to appreciate that. So maybe now is a good time we take a little focus down to our neighbor at the south, right? So maybe you can ask a two-part question here, or answer a two-part question, really. So the first one is, you know, how does the U.S. and Mexico, our neighbors to the south, share the waters of the Colorado River? I know from my perspective and from talking to colleagues here in the water industry in the Southwest, we know that there's somewhat of a contentious political relationship that's been going on between U.S. and Mexico. We read about it in the newspapers all the time. So, you know, can you kind of give us a 30,000-foot view of what that relationship is like today and where you see it going in the future?
Sure thing. The Colorado River is really managed between the two countries under a unique and flexible legal system. Back during World War II in 1944, United States and Mexico signed a water treaty. And that water treaty governs the Colorado River, also the Rio Grande over in New Mexico. What it did was it set forth the ground rules. How much water should the United States deliver? Where should it deliver it? How was it going to deliver it? And it was innovative. It looked ahead. It said, what will we do in shortage? What will we do during regular conditions? What can we do during surplus? But it didn't lay out all the rules. So the treaty's writers, I really have to commend them when we look back, because they allowed for implementation. They allowed for things to change a little bit as we moved forward without having to go back to the original treaty. And these implementing agreements we call minutes, and there's over 300 of them now. They're set in place by the International Boundary and Water Commission, which has both a Mexican and a United States side. And that's who we've worked with. We've worked with the IBWC, and we work with the country of Mexico, and it's really been a very impressive relationship. Since 1944, the United States has made all of its water deliveries. We've had droughts in that time. We've had flooding in that time. But every single year, the United States has made its deliveries. But Mexico is a full part of the river, and they saw the same risk that we saw. 20 years of drought with the possibility of that continuing. So Mexico came to the table, and they took leadership, and they said they were willing to contribute to the system, to saving water behind Lake Mead to help protect the system, and they would do that if the U.S. was willing to do the same. So today, with the drought contingency plans being signed in May, both countries are fully committed to protecting Lake Mead, to making investments, to investing in each other, and it's a very productive and successful relationship.
Well, here in California, you know, our listeners know that we receive all the water not only from Colorado River, but we receive water from the northern part of the state. So how is your organization involved in the Northern California process?
So the Colorado River isn't the only place that's faced severe drought. In the last decade, and while I lived in Sacramento, we faced some of the driest years in California's history. So Southern California gets a significant part of its water supply from the Sacramento River. Up north, there's two main projects, and that is the Central Valley Project, that's run by Reclamation, and then there's the State Water Project, that is run by California. So together with the state, we deliver water to over 25 million people, to millions of acres of farmland, and that water supports the economies from Northern California by Shasta to the Bay Area to San Diego and all of that farmland in between. So the Central Valley Project is a massive federal system, and it complements the State Water Project. They work side by side. But just a note, we were talking about that storage on the Colorado River, four times the average annual flow. But between the state and federal projects, we have less than a year's storage on the Sacramento River. So we really don't have the flexibility that we see on the Colorado side. Let me give an example. In 2017, wettest year on record up north. But in 2018, from the federal side, we weren't able to make our full water deliveries. In fact, at one point, it was an average year, 2018. I wasn't sure if we could deliver any water at all to some of our customers. It's so interesting because the Sacramento River has about the same amount of flow as the Colorado River, but just so much less flexibility. So when we look at the projects, both projects operate under biological opinions, but they were put in place over 10 years ago. Well, we've learned a lot in 10 years. And the state, the water users, Reclamation, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars to update our understanding. We've hundreds of millions of dollars in science. And now we're looking to update our operations so we can match that best available science. As an example, these old biological opinions, they used educated guesses to put in place hard calendar dates about how we would operate. The idea being that at a specific date, it seems likely that salmon might be migrating or that Delta smelt might be near where we're operating. And the idea was for them to put in hard calendar dates that said you would maybe reduce your operations at these times of year. Well, now it's 10 years later, we have real-time information. We have boats in the water every single week. We are looking at when the fish are migrating. We know exactly when they are near our operations. And what we're trying to do with this new understanding is both the state and the federal government have gone to the fish services, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, and we've asked them to consult on our operations. And right now, we're working with them on new biological opinions. So new ways to take advantage of our better understanding so we can deliver water and do that in an environmentally sound manner for species.
All right. That's, again, another great answer to a question. We know that the USBR cooperates, consults, and has lots of programs and efforts and ideas and examples here in the U.S., but we also know or understand that just last week, You and your team represented the United States at the World Water Week, which is an annual conference, took place in Stockholm, Sweden. What did the reclamation group highlight there, and what did you learn about other water challenges around the world?
It was a really great opportunity to take part in World Water Week. Reclamation's engineers were recognized worldwide for our infrastructure, for understanding, for looking at complex issues and finding solutions. So while in Stockholm, we met with a number of countries to share our expertise, to look ahead to being able to share our expertise. But really, what was great was the ability to share what we're working on. So we were talking about boundaries. How do you deliver water between boundaries? And our cooperation with Mexico is just, it's a very, I think, important story to be sharing with the world. You know, we heard from so many other countries, India, Mali, places in Africa, just all of the different issues they're facing. And they're all unique to their own particular situation. You know, they might have political strife. They really don't have many places the infrastructure that we're blessed with. And so those are unique. What was really interesting was we also have so many things that are the same. You know, there can be mistrust between parties. Do we have good data? Are we being transparent with how we share information? So we were there to share our experiences, and that was with Mexico, but also to talk about our work with tribal nations, our work with the Navajo Nation, and building the infrastructure that the Navajo Nation needs to bring them water supplies in New Mexico. It was great to present on everything we're doing. It was an incredible opportunity to learn from what others are facing, and just a real good opportunity for Reclamation to continue its outreach worldwide.
Well, we sponsor the Wyland Foundation. I don't know if you're familiar with them. We do a National Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation every year. And one of the winners of the categories was Gallup, New Mexico. We went out there and met people from the Navajo Nation and such, and they were talking about the projects that you guys are working with them, and I was totally amazed. But, you know, as I said earlier at the beginning, we appreciate you taking the time to be on the show and to be respectful. I just have one more question, if I may. And it's kind of your vision and what you see as you look at all the water issues across the West and also around the world, because you know what those all are. What are you most concerned about? And is there a particular challenge that kind of worries you the most?
What I'm most concerned about is, are we preparing for the next generation? We need to take action now so that 20, 30, 40 years from now, our next generations will be safe, they'll have reliable water and power supplies. I worry that the infrastructure we rely on today was mostly built in the 1930s and 40s. My grandfather helped build infrastructure on the Deschutes River in Oregon. But what are we building today? How are we preparing so the next generation has reliable water and power? That's what I think about. That's what I think Reclamation is uniquely suited to work on.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm blown away by listening to you, and I enjoyed, like I said last time I heard you speak, and I know our listeners hopefully got a lot more informed today than before. That's why we do these shows and want to bring this to our listeners all across the country.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Brenda, before we close off?
No, Chris, Rob, really appreciate the opportunity to be speaking out to your water following, and I think it's a great chance. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and keep doing the good work you're doing. We're sure behind you 1,000%.
Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. That was a great session. I appreciate Ms. Berman coming on the show, and those kind of people are hard to get, and I'm glad she came on our show. We do work with them a lot as our company, the Toro Company, and appreciate that a lot. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Everybody have a good week. Stay cool because it's hot out here. I don't know what it's back all over the world, but it's hot. But remember, the most important thing you got to do, as Chris and I always tell you, think blue, and we'll talk to you next week. Have a good week.